Hello guys, welcome back to another episode of Musings of a Tired Nigerian Girl. Let's get into it.
Book 2, 4. When I got to Madame Coteau's bar early that evening, the place was shut. I knocked but no one opened. I waited for a while. A man with one leg and a pair of crutches made from flowering branches came up to me. "Is it shut? Has she closed down?" he asked. "I don't know." "Shame," he replied. He had sand on his hair. His face was twisted as though he had witnessed great evil. The stump of his amputated leg was covered with a filthy cloth. He looked up at the signboard, spat, and hobbled away. I ran to the backyard. There was a fire blazing. Madame Coteau's cauldron of pepper soup bubbled away. Its steam looked like tormented genies. Further on, hidden by the bushes, was Madame Coteau's massive form. At first, I thought she was doing something quite private, so I looked away. But when I looked again, she had straightened and was inspecting the white beads which she dug into the ground at night and unearthed in the day. She emerged from the bushes with a cutlass in one hand, the white beads in another. "What are you staring at?" she asked gruffly, hiding the beads. "Nothing." She hurried away to her room. When I saw her next, she was wearing the white beads around her neck. She came to the fire and threw some ingredients into the cauldron. The soup made a serious hiss, almost of protestation. It bubbled turbulently within the cauldron. Then it foamed and spilled over, nearly putting out the fire. Madame Coteau said to the soup, "Be quiet." The fire blazed, and to my astonishment, the soup became calm, as if it had never been boiling. "The bar is shut," I said. "Yes," she replied. "What happened?" She didn't say anything. The soup was turbulent again. It swelled into green foam, its bubbles a little monstrous and glutinous, and when they burst, a powerful fragrance came over the air. "What did you put in the soup?" "Demons," she said, glancing at me. "To attract customers?" I asked. She glanced at me again, her eyes bright with curiosity. "What gave you that idea?" "No one." "So why did you ask?" "I just asked." "Don't ask too many questions, you hear?" I nodded. "Are you hungry?" I was, but I said no. She smiled in a manner that didn't make her less fearsome and said, "Look after the soup, I'm coming." But she went. She shuffled towards her room, and as soon as she had gone, the cauldron hissed and the soup overflowed. "Be quiet," I said. The soup gathered into a tremendous wave of foam and rushed over the sides. Before I could do anything, it completely put out the fire. Poured over the wood, I became little green ripples on the sand. "Madame Coteau, the fire has gone out," I called. She came over, looked at the fire, saw the soup streaking the sand like batik dyeing, and said, "What did you do to it?" "Nothing." She bent over and got the fire going again, blowing at the embers. I stared at the soft folds of flesh on her neck. She stood up.
"Don't touch it," she said, and was about to return to her room when we heard commotion from the bar front. Two men, one fat with a bandaged neck, the other stout, leaning on a blue walking stick, were banging away at the bar door. "Madam, aren't you open? We want some palm wine and your famous pepper soup." "Not yet open," she said. "Come back later." They looked disappointed and they grumbled about how some people are not serious about business, but they left. "Troublemakers," she said, and went off to have her usual bath before evening customers began to arrive. I watched over the soup. I got very hot from the heat of the fire and the infernal sun. I got bored with the soup. It boiled away quite remarkably. It no longer bubbled and seemed to have given up its demons. Occasionally, an impatient customer turned up and rattled the door, and I had to go and tell them that the bar hadn't opened yet. They all seemed parched and their tongues hung out as they regarded me. After a while, when I felt sure the soup could take care of itself, I wandered down the path to ease my own restlessness. Steadily, over days and months, the path had been widening. Bushes were being burned, tall grasses cleared, tree stumps uprooted. The area was changing. Places that were thick with bush and low trees were now becoming open spaces of soft river sand. In the distance, I could hear the sounds of grain, of engines, of road builders, forest clearers, and workmen chanting as they strained their muscles. Each day, the area seemed different. Houses appeared where parts of the forest had been. Places where children used to play and hide were now full of sand piles and rotted with house foundations. There were signboards on trees. The world was changing, and I went on wondering as if everything would always be the same. It took longer to get far into the forest. It seemed that the trees, feeling that they were losing their arguments with human beings, had simply walked deeper into the forest. The deeper in I went, the more I noticed the difference. The grounds were covered in white sand. Piles of brick and cement were everywhere. Further on by the path, there were patches of dried excrement. The smell compounded the dryness of the air. I stood under a withering bamboo tree, and a cat appeared in front of me. It looked up and went into the forest. I followed it till we were got to a clearing covered in leaves and rubber seeds. It was very cool and smelled like the body of a great mother. Insects sizzled and birds piped all around as antelope ran past with her little ones. I lay down and slept. I hadn't been sleeping long when I heard my name ringing through the trees. I remembered Madame Koto and ran back to the bar. When I got to the backyard, the fire was smoldering. The cauldron had been removed from the grate and was on the floor. Madame Koto came out of her room and said, "I thought you were bathing." "Bathing? How can I? Where have you been? Playing? Where? Along the paths? I thought you were bathing. Come." I followed her. She opened the back door of the bar. The light flooded in. Lizards scattered from the tables. A sleek gecko inched up the wall. The bar was a mess. It was almost unrecognizable. There was vomit on the floor. Benches were scattered and upturned. Tables were in unusual positions. Fish and chicken bones were all over the floor. Spits, palm wine stank, covered in flies, and columns of ants had formed around the walls. The place looked wrecked. It had the air of a ransacked and deserted marketplace. "What happened?" "Troublesome customers," was all she said. We set to work, clearing the place. I swept the floor and brushed out all the sands, removed the tables. She poured sand on the vomit and swept it out to the front. Rearranged the benches. I sprinkled water on the floor and swept again. Areas of the madman's piss were still greenish. The cross-eyed spirits had gone. As we moved the tables, Madame Koto farted. I was startled by the sudden voluminous noise. Her face showed no sign that I had noticed. She sprinkled disinfectant over the vomit stains, and then she opened the front door for air to come through. Then she went to have her bath. The wind didn't really come through the bar. It was stuffy and smelled of Madame Koto's fat. I went outside for a while, and when I came back in, the smell had cleared. I sat in my corner while Madame Koto struggled with the gourds and calabashes outside. Some of her women friends came to see her on their way back from hawking. "My daughter's husband," they said to me as they passed through the bar with basins on their heads. In the backyard, they talked about politics, about the thugs of politicians, and how businessmen and chiefs sprayed money at parties and celebrations. Madame Koto fed them, and they prayed for her prosperity, and they left. Their voices low and sweet as they chattered their way down the street. As the evening wore on, the bar stayed empty. No one came. I slept, and I was woken up by a lizard that had dropped from the wall. I got up and saw a man sitting at a table. He had a swollen eye, and his lower lip was unnaturally thick. He spoke in a heavy, slow voice, as if he found words too bulky to roll over his big lip. "Is that how you treat customers?" he asked. I called for Madame Koto. She came in, and the man said, "Have my friends come yet?" "What friends?" "My friends. No one has come yet. You wanted some palm wine?" "I will only drink when my friends arrive. They have all the money." "I will serve you," said Madame Koto, "and when they come, you can pay me." "I will wait," insisted the man. Madame Koto went out. The man sat perfectly still. Then he shut his good eye. His bloated eye stayed open. Soon he was asleep and began to snore. I had been looking at him intently for a while when I became aware that the bar was filling up. I looked round and saw no one except the man. But the bar was full of drunken and argumentative voices, laughter, vitriolic abuses, and unrestrained merriment of hard-drinking men. I went and told Madame Koto about it. "Rubbish," she said, following me. When we got into the bar, the voices had materialized and the place was quite full. "Plenty of people," she said, eyeing me. I was surprised, but when I sat down, my surprise turned to bewilderment. The people in the bar were stranger than any I had seen before. The group that sat round the man with the bloated eye looked alike. Their eyes were all swollen and their lips were big and bruised. At first, I thought they were all boxers. Then I noticed that two of them had only one hand each, and the original man had only three fingers. He wore rings on all the fingers. They talked loudly, but their voices were disproportionately more powerful than the movements of their mouth. Across from them sat two men dressed identically in agbada of fish-printed material. They both wore skull caps and very dark glasses. I was convinced that they were both blind, but they talked and gesticulated as though they had perfect sight. On another table, there was a man who sat alone. He had no thumbs, and his head, amazingly contorted like certain tubers of yam, was altogether bald. He wore a wristwatch that ticked loudly, and when he yawned, I saw that he had no teeth at all, in spite of looking quite young. There was a woman next to him whose skin was more indigo than dark brown. She kept adjusting her shoulders and did not smile or speak. Madame Kuto came round to serve them. "These are my friends," the original man with the bloated eye said. "Where do you all come from?" Madame Kuto asked. "Here, this country, this city. Here we live, here we die." Just as he finished speaking, two albino men came in. They were freckled, their eyes were green, they were quite beautiful. Their eyes kept shutting and opening, wobbling from side to side as if they couldn't stand the light. The rest of the company cheered them as they came in. They smiled and took their seats opposite the toothless young man. "What do you want to drink?" "Palm wine, naturally, and your famous pepper soup," said the original man. Madame Koto went out to serve them. While she was out, a very tall man and woman came in. Their legs were very long. The rest of their bodies were quite short. They had small heads and eyes and were so tiny that it was only when they came near me that I could perceive their pinpoint brightness. They came over, stood perfectly straight for a moment, and then, like bizarre actor, they leaned over me to keep their legs and top half straight and said in voices that could only have come from children, "We want some pepper soup, please." I ran out and told Madame Koto, "Leave me alone, I'm coming," she said. I went back in. The tall couple had seated themselves at my table. They sat straight and their knees were awkward beneath the table, and I noticed that they had the longest necks I had seen on any human being. "Are you politicians?" I asked. "What?" asked the man in the child's voice. "Politicians. What is that?" "You're not politicians," I said, closing the conversations. They kept glancing at me and I found their faces very disconcerting. I tried to sit there without noticing them when the woman brought out a feather from her wrapper and offered it to me. "No, thank you," I said. She smiled and put it back. Madame Koto came in with a gourd of palm wine and voices erupted in weird jubilation. I fetched glasses and cups and distributed them round. When I gave the cups to the men with dark glasses, they grabbed my hand and said, "What's your name?" "Why? We like you. We want to take you with us." "Where?" "Wherever." "No, yes." I tried to wrench my hand free from their grip, but their very strong grips and their bony fingers bit into my flesh. "No, yes." I pulled again, but my flesh bruised and began to bleed. I screamed, but the voices in the room were so loud that they cut off my screaming. I kicked, missed, and hurt my toes on the foot of the table. Then I scratched one of them in the face and snatched off his glasses. Both of his eyes were totally white. They could have been made of milk. They were white and blank and unmoving as if they had been struck there, malformed in an empty socket. I opened my mouth to shout, but the man laughed so powerfully and his mouth was so black that I froze in my attempts. I couldn't move. I felt transfixed as if I were suffering a living rigor mortis when a searing pain went up my spine and ended in my brain. And I woke up to find myself in my usual corner with the tall, small-eyed couple staring at me. Everyone else was drinking. Steaming bowls of pepper soup were in front of all the customers. They drank steadily and talked in curious voices. The two albino men kept twisting and jerking as if their bodies were uncomfortable. They were silent. The toothless man was also silent. They all kept looking at me. More customers came into the bar. There was a man with a head like that of a camel, a woman with a terrible hip deformation, another man with white hair and a midget. The woman had a large sack on her back, which she gave to the albinos. The albinos unfurled the sack, shook it out, sending dust clouds into the air. They glanced at me furtively and hid the sack under the table. The four people who had come in looked for places to sit and then crowded my table. I had to get up for them. I fetched a little stool and sat near the earthenware pot and watched the bar become overcrowded. Amidst all this, Madame Koto was radiant with her necklace of white beads. As the evening progressed, she got darker, more dignified, while the clientele got rowdier. She was untouched by it all, even when the men teased her. The original man with the big eye, which got more bloated as he drank, as if his eye were stomached all to itself, said, "Madam, come and sit on my lap. Let's see if you can carry your wine first before you carry me," she replied with great dignity. "This Madame Couture is too proud," said another man in the identical group. "Proud and strong," she said. "Come and sit with me. Let's talk about marriage," said the man whose head was like a tube of yam. "Marry yourself." "So you don't think I am man enough?" asked the original man, waving his three fingers for more wine. "No," she said. The bar rocked with the odder sound of ironic laughter. The men with dark glasses laughed very hard and banged away at the table. "Maybe that boy is her husband," said one of them, taking off his glasses and polishing them. His white eyes didn't move. They were so bird-like, so ghostly, that I couldn't tell what or where they were looking at. "That's my son," she said. "Is that so?"
"Yes."
"Will you sell him to us?" The bar suddenly became very quiet. Madame Couture stared at the two men with dark glasses. All the other customers watched her carefully. Then she turned to me, a curious gleam in her eyes. "Why?" "So that we can take him with us. To where? Many places." "For how much?" "As much as you want. You have plenty money." "Too much." The silence in the bar was incredible. The midget laughed. He laughed like a goat. The tall man with small eyes laughed as well. He sounded like a hyena. "Name your price, madame." Madame Couture looked at the customers as if seeing them for the first time. "Any more palm wine for anybody?" "Palm wine," they cried in unison. "And pepper soup." And they all burst out laughing and resumed their voracious conversations as if nothing had happened. Madame Couture served them and they drank and ate and kept asking for more. They drank a great deal and didn't get drunk. They sat, all of them, drinking and talking as if the wine were water. It was only the two men in their glasses who got drunk. They kept polishing their glasses. One of them even brought out an eye and polished it and blew on it and dipped it into his palm wine and pushed it back into his red eye socket. Then he put his glasses back on. They chewed and swallowed their chicken bones. They ate and drank so much that Madame Couture began to despair. She had run out of palm wine and food, and the night hadn't even properly set in. As she bustled up and down, starting a new fire, making hurried arrangements for more palm wine, the midget came up to me, smiling very expansively. He said, "Take this, you might need it." It was a little penknife. I put it in my pocket and forgot all about it. Then he went to the backyard. I heard him urinating in the bushes. He came back smiling and left without a word and without paying. I told Madame Couture about it and she said, "Which midget?" I went back to the bar. I sat down. The tall man said, "Come with me." "To where?" "I will take you around the world on foot. I make all my journeys on foot like a camel." "No. If you don't come with me, I will take you by force." "You can't." He smiled. The woman smiled as well. I decided they were more drunk than I thought and I ignored them. The bar was so full of people that there were no seats left. Some of them sat on the floor. I was notched off my stool. The smells in the bar became terrible and strange. The smell of corpses and rain and oregano, of mangoes and rotten meat, of incense and goat's hair. Then suddenly, I found I could no longer understand what anybody was saying. They all spoke as if they had known one another for a long time. They spoke in alien languages and occasionally pointed at Madame Couture's fetish. It seemed to amuse them. Then they glanced at me, made calculations with their fingers, laughed, drank, became solemn, and looked at me again. Madame Couture came in and announced that her supply of food and wine was finished. She demanded that they pay up and leave her bar. A great chorus of disappointment rose from the clientele. "Pay and go," Madame Couture said. "Pay up and go. I'm closing up for the night." No one paid her much attention. Her temper rising, she stormed out of the bar. The voices grew rowdier, wilder. Previously, I had heard the voices before the people had materialized. Now I heard the voices, but as I looked around, the customers were vanishing. I shut my eyes in disbelief. When I opened them, the bar was completely empty and completely noisy, except for the two albinos and a beautiful woman who I hadn't noticed before. On the far table were two pairs of dark glasses, the original man with the bloated eye, the group that looked like him, the tall couple, the two wide-eyed men were all gone. The bar was silent and everything was still and the wind whistled faintly on the ceiling as if a hurricane had passed and hadn't been noticed. "Where is everyone?" I asked the albino. The beautiful woman smiled at me. The albinos twisted, shrugged, stood up and spread out their sack. The woman distracted me with her smile, and then the albino sprang at me, covered me with the sack. I struggled and fought, but they expertly bundled me in and tied up the sack as if I were an animal. and as I resisted kicking, I heard the noises of the world, the voices of all the different people who had been in the bar. They talked in their inhuman languages in leisurely animation as if they were merely setting out on a pilgrimage to a distant land. Overcome with fear, unable to move, surrounded by darkness and the death smells of the sack, I cried, politicians are taking me away. My voices were very faint, as if I were shouting in a dream. Even if I had cried out with the voice of thunder, no one could have heard me. They took me down many roads, rough handling me in the sack. They swung me round, they changed me from one shoulder to another, and then the sack kept tightening about me. I heard the noises of lorries and cars, the tumultuous sounds of a marketplace. All the time I fought and struggled like a trapped animal. The more I strained for freedom, the more they tightened the sack till I had no room to struggle. My feet were around my head and my neck was twisted to breaking point. I couldn't breathe and I fought the panic that washed over me in waves. The blankness of death came upon me. I shut my eyes. It was no different when I opened them. At one point, I fell into a strange sleep in which the figure of a king, resplendent in gold, appeared to me and vanished. My spirit companions began singing in my ears, rejoicing in my captivity and in the fact that I would soon be joining them. I could not shut out their singing, and I'm not sure which was worse, being bundled away by unknown people to an unknown destination or hearing my spirit companions orchestrate my passage through torment with their sweet and excruciating voices. When I had fought and my energy was exhausted and I couldn't do anything, I called to our great king and I said, I do not want to die. I had hardly finished when the figure of the king appeared to me again and dissolved into the face of the midget. By now I had ceased to hear any sounds outside except the rushing of waves and hissing of water and the neighing of birds. Suddenly I remembered the penknife the midget had given me and began another struggle to find it. I searched my pockets, I searched the stack and couldn't find it. My fear became unbearable. Then a quietness came over me. I gave up accepting my destiny. Water poured into the sack. I became convinced that I was being taken to an underwater kingdom where they say certain spirits reside. As I tried to keep the water out of my mouth, I felt something metallic like a frozen fish banging against my head. It was the penknife. I wasted no time in cutting my way out. The sack material was very tough, but the water had softened it a little, and it took some time to cut my way out, and when I did, the outside world was black, like the bottom of a well. I fell out of the water with a splash. The boy has escaped, a voice cried. It was very dark and the river could have been the night and the water was bitingly cold. I stayed under without moving and then very gently I swam back to shore, serene in my element. I struggled through the bulrushes and the tiger lilies of the marsh, over twisted mangrove roots and flickering eels, and when I gained the soft silt sand, I went on running till I got to a main road. It was very dark. I was hungry, wet, lost, and I heard voices all around me. The twittering, vicious voices of my spirit companions, wailing in disappointment. I ran till the roads became a river of voices, every tree, car, and face talking at me. Cats crossing my path, people with odd night faces staring at me knowingly. At crossroads, people glared and seemed to float towards me menacingly. I fled all through the night. The road was endless. One road led to a thousand others, which in turn fed into paths, which fed into dirty tracks, which became streets, which ended in avenues and cul-de-sacs. All around, a new world was being erected amidst the old. Skyscrapers stood high and inscrutable beside huts and zinc abodes. Bridges were being built, flyovers half finished were like passageways into the air or like future visions of a time when cars would be able to fly. Roads half constructed were crowded with heavy machinery. Here and there, night watchmen slept under the stars with dull lamps as their only earthly illumination. The moon was round and big and it seemed bright with the face of an awesome king. I was comforted by its presence. I walked on with a terrible hunger for a destination, for mom's face and dad's smells. I walked past the kerosene lamps of the Smorton Street traders. Small boy, where are you going this time? They often asked me, but I replied to no one. I wandered till my bare feet broke into blisters, and then I walked about in the darkness of being lost. I saw a disembodied light ahead of me, a tiny moon, the shape of a man's head.
I followed the light and it led me on longer journeys. And when I got to an area I vaguely recognized, my feet gave up on me and I collapsed at the roadside. I crawled to the nearest tree and curled myself up beneath its great roots, which were above the ground, and I fell asleep under the safety of the waning moon. The mosquitoes tormented me, the ants bit into my flesh, and their stings persisted. But I slept through it all and dreamt about a panther. When I awoke, the moon was still in the sky, like a ghost unwilling to disappear under the force of daylight. It was dawn. A few people were standing over me with puzzlement on their faces. "He's not dead," one of them cried. I got up quickly. He came towards me with arms outstretched. I fled from them. I ran through the quickening dawn and the sun riding the sky. The air heated, the sand warmed under my feet, and women of the new African churches who wore white smocks and rang bells cried out to the sleeping world to awake and repent. I passed prophets emerging from the forest with dews and leaves in their hair, cobwebs meshing their beards, their eyes demented with visions. I passed sorcerers with machetes that cracked with flames in the morning light, making sacrifices at dawn of red cocks who poured gnomic chants on the untrodden roads. I also passed workers who had woken early and with sleepy faces made their ways through the mist pierced by the sun to the garages and bus stops. My feet were fresh on the paths. Dews wet my ankles. Hunger dried my lips. News vendors roused the dawn with their horns, announcing to the awakening world the scandal of the latest political violence. The industrious women of the city, who carried basins of prepared aromatic foods in their head, tempted the appetites of the world with their sweet voices. The worms of the road ate into the soles of my feet. I came to another familiar place, the passionate chants of the Muslim roused by the Muslim world to a prayer. I had turned a corner and had gone up a path that became a track when three men in blue smocks rushed at me. I tore into the bushes, ran amongst the trees, and cried out into the echoing forest. Birds scattered from the branches and pods fell from the treetops. I shook off the men, but I went on running, for the world seemed populated with people intent on me for one obscure reason or another. While running through the forest paths, I stepped on an enamel plate of sacrifices to the roads. The plate was rich with offerings of fried yams, fish, stewed snails, palm oil, rice, and kola nuts, shell fragments, and little pins stuck in the soles of my feet. I started to bleed. I was so hungry that I ate what I could of the offerings to the road, and afterwards my stomach swelled and visions of road spirits, hungry and annoyed, weaved in my brain. I went on bleeding, and a black cat with golden eyes followed the trail of my blood. My head boiled with hallucinations. I walked on broken glass, on the hot sand of bush paths, on hot new tarmac. The road seemed to me then to have a cruel and infinite imagination. All the roads multiplied, reproducing themselves, subdividing themselves, turning in on themselves like snakes' tails in their mouth, twisting themselves into labyrinths. The road was the worst hallucination of them all, leading towards home and then away from it without end, with too many signs and no directions. The road became my torment, my aimless pilgrimage, and I found myself merely walking to discover where all the roads lead to, where they end. And then I came to a place where I thought the roads terminated. An iroko tree had been felled across it. The tree was mighty, its trunk gnarled and rough like the faces of ancient warriors. It looked like a great soul, dead at the road's end. Beyond the road, shared into a deep pit. Across on the other side were sand-carrying lorries. Strange sounds leaped into the tree trunks, voices echoed in its hollows. I sat on a branch of tree to ease my feet. And then, while the road spirits raged in me, I saw a two-legged dog emerge from the forest. It stopped and regarded me, whimpering frequently. I was so amazed to see the dog standing on only two legs that I forgot my hunger and pain. It had a left forefoot and a right hind foot, and it stood wobbling as though on invisible crutches. The dog stared at me, and with a heavy, inconsolable sadness, it turned and limped away. In my astonishment at seeing it walk, I followed it as it limped on curiously. The two-legged dog led me through the forest. It was a lean dog with intense eyes and a sensitive tail and flea-ridden ears. I wanted to get rid of the fleas, but I restrained myself and followed it at a distance till I came to a clearing. I recognized the clearing at once. The dog limped on deeper into the forest. I watched it go and stopped only once to look at me. I waved, but the dog did not understand my gesture. It went on limping, a solitary and heroic dog surviving with only two legs and a hard, sad face. I carried on home. At the edge of the forest, I saw Madame Couture with a plate of chicken and yam in her hands, the white beads wearing round her neck. She stopped at the roadside, looked in all directions to make sure no one was about, and proceeded with her passionate supplications. I watched her secret forever. When she had finished with her praying and chanting, she lit a candle and put it on the plate. She placed a finger of cow line and some cowries beside the candle. Then she straightened, undid her handkerchief, looked in all directions, and hurried away. I passed her road offering. I scurried past her bar front. I ran home. Dad was sitting on his three-legged chair smoking a cigarette. There were plates of uneaten food on the table. Mom was in the bed. The window was open and the light that came in increased the unhappiness in the room. Mom rushed at me and threw her arms around me as if to protect me from punishment. She made me sit on the bed and began weeping. Dad didn't move. "Where have you been?" he asked in a dangerous voice. It was clear that neither of them had slept that night. There were circles of sleeplessness round Dad's eyes. Mom looked at though she had lost weight overnight. "Where have you been?" "I was lost." "How did you get lost?" "I played and got lost." "How?" "I don't know." "What about Madame Couture?" "I don't know." "She came looking for you last night." I said nothing. "You didn't tell her where you were going." "I can't remember." "Have you eaten?" "Don't ask him such questions," Dad said loudly. "First, he must tell me where he has been. Let him sleep." "That is how you women spoil your children. Let him rest, then he will talk. If he doesn't talk, he won't rest." "He has prevented my going to work. I wanted to know what he has been doing." "Azaro, tell your father where you've been." "I got lost." "Where?" Dad's voice rose. He sat up straight. His chair wobbled. So, this particular chapter was quite long. It was more than 7 pages. If not, yeah, totally more than 7 pages. And we're already in by 31 minutes. So, I'm just going to leave it here for now. And next week, we will continue chapters 5 and maybe 6, depending on how long it is. I don't want it to go on and on and on for like an hour. So, yeah. I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. Let's meet same time. You know how we do it every Saturday by 10 a.m. for your weekly dose of The Famished Road by Ben Okri. Have a great day.